Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minig. I'm the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Cristiano Chavez Jr. Cristiano is an experienced licensed social worker. He's currently a PhD student in the social work program of Adelphi University. He has special passions in social work research. He does consulting. He is a community advocate and activist. And he has a long history of working with behavioral health issues, the criminal justice system. So overall, we are all in for a treat, and I'm very excited.
Cristiano, man, again, thank you so much for being on my podcast, man. It's an awesome pleasure.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and I'm really excited to be a part.
Yeah, I really feel like we're going to get into like a lot of good stuff here. You are my first social worker in my podcast, and I think that's awesome. Again, I wanted to start giving into like other avenues, so I want to start interviewing different types of professionals, and again, how we kind of coordinate together too. So this is awesome, man.
Definitely, I'm excited to share what I know and what I do.
Awesome. Well, right off the bat, I just have to ask you, what really got you into the behavioral health field? Like, are you surprised that you're here right now in your life?
It's interesting because it's like I always had a passion for helping others. Kind of when we grow up and we start thinking about helping other people and what kind of jobs are there. For me, it was really getting connected with where I live. Born and raised on Long Island, New York, and it's very suburban. So it's just like, just helping others got me a sense of connection. And then as the years gone on, more dealing with a lot of issues myself in regards to like my mental health and dealing as a social worker who also is living with bipolar disorder, it kind of was something that was impacting me, but in a way where I wanted to learn more about mood disorders and bipolar disorder and other mental illnesses that are so prevalent, but many people try to ignore, especially in the Latino community. So it was something that I was always interested in, just growing from that. And then several situations where I myself, and I definitely say much of what I do in my profession is drawn from the passion I have from dealing with the justice system myself, and fighting through a case that was luckily able to be dismissed, but the trauma itself really impacted how I connect or how I see the justice system overall. And it kind of gave me this sense that this is the area I want to get into. And just being able to understand how the justice system works. And you don't have to be an attorney to learn about the justice system or the policies and laws and legislations that are passed that either promote violence or exclude those who can get help. So dealing with that, I got interested in going to, I took a social work class in college, and I was like, that's it, I'll be a social worker. Because it was more interesting, it was more proactive as opposed to it's academic. So I got into a graduate program. I was a part-time student for 3 years, and took a class. It was my first year, first semester class. It was human behavior, of course. Everyone has to take it. It runs again. I took a class. We were required to take a class on social welfare.
Okay.
Understanding social welfare, more so understanding like theories, perspectives, and understanding social injustices. And that was it. That was it. For me, it was like, I don't think therapy and clinical social work is my drive. I feel like I'm getting more closer to learning about these government bodies and understanding how bills and proposals are put together, how policies impact our communities and such. So that was it. Like, I got myself together and focused much of my graduate program, focusing assignments, that were given and using topics that were related to criminal justice to give me more insight into, so basically teaching myself in a way, but also being able to see different perspectives through each class on aspects of the justice system.
Mm-hmm. So when you discuss about that stuff, it's very interesting because I'm not going to say I relate, but I, as an LADC, I have a lot of clients that are so-called in the system, and some of their stories are just extremely sad and how easily they get felonies and how difficult it is to get out of that system.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's very harsh, being that through federal, like on a federal perspective, there's not one single way a state can institute reentry policies. So what's working in New York, if New York is having much more more of a focus of the reentry population, how to connect folks reentering into community from long-term incarceration into resources, getting connected to resources like employment, housing, common and necessary resources that would, in a state that may more so be pro punishment, mm-hmm. in an aspect, will make it very difficult to obtain those, kind of adding to the circle of a person leaving prison, coming home with no resources, and most likely to return back to prison, mm-hmm. for other offenses.
Have you ever watched that Netflix special, Khalif Browder?
Yeah, I actually I spoke about it and we watched it. I showed it to my students.
So powerful. I show it to my clients as well.
Yeah, it's very deep because it's not just about the whole situation and the fighting for it and the injustice that took place. But it really highlights the mental health, and that's the thing about what a lot of government institutions and those in charge of lobbying or policymaking is that mental health is a deterrent fact to put someone back behind bars if there's no intervention methods or preventative methods that can really help work with those who are living with severe mental illnesses or are experiencing a misdiagnosis or not being diagnosed at all, to really getting them settled and connected, and as well as helping prevent situations that can impose mental health mental illnesses. I mean, trauma is very, very common in neighborhoods that are high risk, and I would say specifically neighborhoods that are gang active. And yeah. So I've worked with kids before in detention centers, and they will say, I've learned to duck from my window if I hear a bullet gun, a shot, I'm afraid that bullet's going to go through the window and hit someone. And it's that desensitized concept of the trauma that they're experiencing is that would promote a lot of other issues that is usually common that I see working with folks that are just as involved.
Like they're always kind of in a state of danger too, where they can't stay calm and make again good healthy decisions, especially when it comes to like forming relationships, right?
Yeah, and it's crazy because it's like much of the work I've done is on Long Island, in particular to Nassau County, and very, very, there's a lot of history of Long Island itself when it comes to racial segregation. So a lot of towns and locations have different zip codes, have different forms of focus on resources for the community, and then others experiencing not enough in their budget to provide such resources. So it's like this shift in income levels, and they're very basically, anyone can really just drive through Long Island and they manage to see the differences of certain neighborhoods. Yeah. And with that, it's like I usually tell folks that I connect with, some kids strive to succeed, and a lot of kids are coming from neighborhoods that are high income and have really a wealth of resources in their backyards, and others strive to survive. And those are usually a lot of school districts that experience deficits in budgeting or lack of social workers or mental health professionals and lack of many things, actually. So that narrative usually sticks to me because it's something that we are not really, we tend to ignore when we look at someone and what they do, or if someone does commit a crime, the reasons behind it.
Mm-hmm. That's your passion. Yes. One thing I also too want to discuss, let's say, you know, there's students coming up in the social work field and everything. And once, I guess, you get to grad school, it looks a lot different than undergrad social work because you kind of can go down different avenues, right? Can you give us like a better idea of that?
Yeah. So it's like certain schools have now specializations. So students may just want to, they want to go to social work, but they also want to go into, let's say, for example, forensic social work. Mm-hmm. Some schools have specific programs that are specialized, that have a specialization in forensic social work, or if you're looking to do palliative care or geriatrics or medical social work. And typically they have specifics that are really helpful for you to just take courses that are primarily focusing on those type of specializations. So students usually get that freedom kind of to pick where they want to go. Mm-hmm. When it comes to schools, like picking which type of specialization you want to get into, but also being able to gain that experience when they're doing field placement that usually the schools require a student to do.
Okay, nice. And another thing I want to ask you personally, since you've been a social worker and you graduated and you're on your path, do you ever coordinate with a lot of different, like, other healthcare professionals, like addiction counselors or case managers? And does that most of the time, I guess, go smoothly, or has there ever been difficulties when it comes to coordination of care?
Yeah, so as a therapist now, and also as a former care coordinator or case manager, it's an interesting collaboration. Mm-hmm. We're designed to work as a team. Sometimes there's miscommunication, but of course, the miscommunication in the reference of who's responsible for doing what. Sometimes we get this specific perception, drug treatment counselor or substance abuse counselor is supposed to work with a person on a therapeutic level. To an extent, yes, but that is also why that's most likely the role of the therapist or mm-hmm. the psychotherapist providing that service. Sometimes, and that's just within like the relationship social worker to social worker or social worker to healthcare providers. To those going for services or on the client perspective, there's always these assumptions. Yes. I'm seeing a drug treatment counselor. This is someone's I have to talk to about, they may consider it to be like counseling or therapy, when in reality it's focusing in particular to one's substance use. Go to a case manager and assume that they're like genie in a bottle and I need this, I need that, I need help, or I need some form of like resources. And it's some of that responsibility, perhaps assuming that they're helping them on a resource level and also a therapeutic level.
Now, can I ask you, do you struggle? Because I was going to ask you earlier, are there a lot of similarities between case management and social working about just obtaining resources for the client? And is there ever, I guess, I don't want to say bumping heads, but I guess boundary crossing?
Yeah. I definitely, from my former experience, it's definitely a bump of heads. I would usually be mistaken as the social worker. And at the time, I was just the case manager. I do the case management aspect of my job, allocating resources and finding resources for clients they need. And it kind of, it's not necessarily the roles or responsibilities, but more so the engagement that kind of would bump heads, because clients would assume I was a therapist when I wasn't. And working with the therapist, there was more of a therapeutic relationship, perhaps at times with me, because of my what responsibilities are as a case manager. So it was always like conflict, just setting that boundary of what I do and what you do and how the client sees that, but also the we as a team are acknowledge that. So we don't kind of add more to others' plates.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we have that same issue here in Minnesota. And I also kind of related to the concept of you talking about the LADC and the mental health therapist, where I got my graduate degree in both. Again, we call it co-occurring. I'm not sure what you guys call it in New York. It's kind of difficult though, because that's not like what someone once told me. When it comes to billing, there's no such thing as co-occurring. You either bill for addiction counseling and you bill for mental health, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah. It's usually, I know for New York State, they're billed separately. And oftentimes that means that for some clients that have to get both therapy and substance use counseling, they have to, because it's billed separately, they may not be able to get both services. And perhaps Medicaid tends to make the assumption that they have to do one service at a time. So it's difficult for some folks who really need it, but they have to wait until either having treatment on another day. If they have difficulties with transportation, it's just like it would be easier to kill two birds with one stone in one day as opposed to having make it difficult for a client to get the help they need.
Yeah. And again, working in the state of Minnesota, I know it's just not just Minnesota, you know, it's a human being thing where, again, egos get in the way. And it's where we struggle sometimes with the mental health therapist working together with the addiction counselor because of those such strong egos. And
that's it. Yeah, that definitely will horrible. Say it's a sense that there's always this we social workers are so accustomed to feeling the sense of hierarchy when it comes to not just with social workers and if they're in the mental health field, professionals like psychologists and psychiatrists, we're kind of seen as below that line that they're at. And our I would say, for an example, I was called to do to testify in court on behalf of a case of a client who was going through the justice system. And my level of expertise wouldn't be as, I would say, appropriate as what a psychologist or psychiatrist may have. Although we are trained as a social worker to learn about mental health and understand severe mental health and other diagnoses and situations. So it's kind of like, we are seen as lesser than that. And then when we're in the field of social work, we see that hierarchy among case managers, social workers, and even within social workers, those with LMSW and those with LCSW kind of see this hierarchy, this kind of like who has the highest, who's on the higher level. And so the ego situation, yes, you definitely start to see a lot of that. If you're seeing that within social work between LMSWs and LCSWs, and if you're seeing that in settings like treatment teams where you have the social worker and a case manager, a social worker and a drug addiction counselor.
Yeah, you know, it's just so funny you say that because the vibe that I get sometimes here in Minnesota is that it's the social workers that are on the top of the heap and the rest of us are actually down below. It's interesting because I had a teacher once tell me the reason like social workers are actually kind of higher up is because they were actually the first therapist ever, I believe, way, way back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, when social work started to became a profession, it was usually to really help connect with, I know through the settlements, social work helped connect those who were migrating migrating from Europe to the United States, and it was a lot of issues regarding biases against certain ethnicities, nationalities, and the growth of homelessness. And so social work that develops settlement houses and put their feet on the ground, but to provide community members with the resources, but also that sense of therapeutic reliance.
Yeah, and I guess another thing too is just, I have to be honest, like growing up, or not, I wouldn't say growing up, but like when I'm starting this field, I started forming biases too. And just to be honest, I am not proud of my ignorance when it came to that about social workers. I really have learned a lot, and I learned to like work with them definitely more efficiently, and they're awesome. It's just, to be honest, it's not so much I disliked them when I first started, but when I was like almost kind of done with graduate school, like there was like so many like cool jobs that I really wanted. But as a mental health therapist, I wasn't even offered them because all they took were social workers. And again, that's not social workers' fault. You know, that's just more of my issues at the time. And yeah, I couldn't get the jobs that I wanted. So I started like developing resentments towards them, when in reality it was just more my own stuff than anything. Another thing too, it's just maybe it's smart on, let's say, hospitals, because my assumption is that it's smart, let's say, just using hospitals as a general setting, they could use a social worker for a lot of different things, right?
Yeah, it's I would definitely say one thing is that with social work, is how marketable it is, because you're pretty much entering a profession where you're working with people, social work. And so, but at certain extents, there are those who go into micro practice and getting into getting into core community organizing or doing macro practice work. It's interesting that, and we're able to get into those kind of positions. But it's also, I guess it's also one thing also is that a lot of professions that search for positions in those higher in meso and macro practices often look for candidates who may just have a degree in criminology or criminal justice or sociology. I mean, oftentimes don't see social work, so it oftentimes discourages people from even wanting to enter that field because they may assume it doesn't apply to them. Definitely, it's I would say, like, just going back, on the top of my head, it kind of, when you brought up more so the with social work, trying to go back, because you mentioned something really important,
like the resources they could do more, or
I would say, like, with social work and other like other careers, it's like there's always this sense of who has the qualifications in terms of, like, in clinical settings, there's those who tend to apply for positions as a therapist, may have a social work degree or may have a mental health counseling degree. There's now more different avenues of degrees and training. And usually it's like, I would say, oftentimes social work tends to be one that is favored because it's of its diverse education background. Certain programs may just focus on counseling. Some programs may, but social work programs kind of touch the base with every single, like, micro, meso, and macro practice. Mm-hmm.
I want to piggyback off of what you said about the clinical aspects of that, because back in my early days in schooling, I don't want to say I developed like a really huge negative attitude towards social work, but I'm just thinking, all right, I'm addiction and I'm also clinical mental health. Like, all my classes are like one-on-one session mental health based. So why wouldn't they want to hire us? Mm-hmm. So I'll call it my ignorant self. I was working as an arms worker at this facility, and a lot of the individuals at the facility were social workers, master level clinicians. They were awesome. And I still, to this day, cannot believe I said what I said, but I'm going to do it now. I'm going to be vulnerable. And just, my boss at the time was a social worker, and she's just talking about doing like one-on-one therapy. And I cannot believe this. I had the audacity to say, well, you know, if you went to a school like Adler, like me, and just in mental health, you would be a better therapist. And she's like, what did you say? And there was that awkward pause. And she's like, that was so extremely disrespectful. And I'm like, I am sorry. I didn't mean to offend you. And to be honest, I learned a lot from that experience because there's so many like research books that I just get into about horrific stories about what therapists kind of do and say. And research also states that it doesn't matter what degree you have. That doesn't determine what a great therapist you can become.
I would say like one thing and interesting. I often would ask myself like why certain positions like require to have an MSW. This was before me even getting one. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to learn is that much of it because of it's with licensing and a lot of agencies requiring focusing on liability. Mm-hmm. It usually becomes we need someone if this is someone signing or put together a legal document, it is done by someone who's credentialed with the license. And that is kind of where the license hierarchy kicks in. What is seen more as respected. Some states have where social workers with an LMSW can practice independently, mm-hmm. but most states require you having a licensed clinical social work license on hold or in your possession to do independent work. So it's kind of like those that kind of that hierarchy itself. Like I said, it's like those who with an LCSW may be seen by other professionals as higher value or more independent in collaborating, mm-hmm. compared to an LMSW who may have to have a supervisor connect with that, work with a supervisor that can oversee their work. So it's just like it's always a sense of hierarchy when it comes to that kind of, that title. In a way.
Yeah. So I want to move along. And like I mentioned before, I said you were a PhD student. Can I ask you what motivated you to become a PhD student? And for all my listeners out there who want to become one, what are the different types of careers you can kind of get into when you become that?
So pretty much I've always wanted to get into a PhD program. I would say since the start of my higher education career, I would say about a little bit over 10 years now that it took me to get to this point where I'm a student. My focus was really I drew a huge love for research. Research to me is something that's a skill that's not just great to have, but also very important, especially as a social worker. If you're looking to do independent practice or you're looking to get understand how to get budgets for programs that you are supervising or directing, it's just the sense of research. One, just being the actual practice of research is great, but the understanding about how research is done was something that caught my attention, and especially because there's not that many male Latino social workers mm-hmm. out there, and not that many who are in PhD programs or getting a doctoral degree. And it's the numbers are small, but nonetheless, we're growing, and a lot of the work that we're doing helps shape and understand, give research a better, a different perspective as to how it's designed and methods to use and how to connect with the work that we're passionate about and the research that we want to do. So I applied back to my alma mater, Adelphi University, and I was definite that I wanted to get into a career that is research. And there are roles in research that you can, that doesn't require a doctorate degree.
My future intention is more so to really lead and be a principal investigator through it, and hopefully getting working through a university. Because I also would say, aside from research, teaching is one thing that is important to me. Being that a lot of
I like to really engage in social policy, and I teach a course on that for graduate students. And it's just, it's a skill set that is important. It's an insight that's crucial as a social worker to really understand. So it got me to doing both. And honestly, with aside from doing like leading research studies or working as a professor at a university, oftentimes those with a PhD in social work and become, I would say, directors of institutes, directors of specific programs or agencies. It's the title helps develop recognition for the work that you're interested, that you have a passion for. What helps you kind of set yourself in a position to take on roles that are that require a expertise and insight on a certain area that you want to do. For me, it's how I'm able to apply research that I conduct and articles that I write or in presentations that I give that focus on policy and how I can be able to help students learn that.
So I have to ask you this right now. What do you like more? Are you more into the one-on-one therapy now, or do you still, again, like you said, love research, like as in number one, or do you like them both equally?
Well, therapy is, I would say both of the work is very rewarding. It's stressful, but rewarding.
Stressful in different ways, maybe, right?
Yes, exactly. And I would say with clinical work, it's some find it that they could do it full time and continue to do it. I find myself as a person that is more into policy and community organizing. It doesn't hurt to have that experience, but it's not as a priority or focus of mine. And that's the thing about social work is that you could pretty much, because of how marketable you can be, there are oftentimes positions where people can become a fee-for-service therapist. So they work with several clients instead of a full caseload. And it's like, I now, like I said, I do a lot of community work and teach and I'm a student, but I'm also a part-time therapist. So it's kind of like
awesome.
Balance it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, since you're big on research, is there any type of research project that really interests you right now in the field or anything you want to maybe dig into in the future?
Yeah. So my research focus revolves around youth at risk, those who are justice involved, and youth at risk for gang involvement, understanding and learning about gang membership, the gang culture, how that influences gang violence, and specifically neighborhoods that experience socioeconomic issues, socioeconomic political issues, as well as understanding how the systems, the juvenile justice system, the criminal justice system, and the judicial system work in the process of those who go through, who are arrested to the day that they re-enter and after. That and as well as immigration and understanding the intersectionality between both and how we as a society can focus on progressive actions that are helpful in developing innovative ways to address criminal justice without punishment of motives or punishment.
Yeah, and I'm sure in New York you get like a lot of petty crime charges for like, let's say, minor drug use depending on the amount and stuff like that, right?
Well, it's interesting. Recently New York legalizing marijuana and minor offenses through the criminal justice reform and bail reform have made. Of course, it's much better than dealing with traditional practices where a person who is caught with marijuana would get arrested and go through that process of arraignment and going to court. But here in New York is kind of where this is like more and more so the victim, the blame game hits. It's like we're seeing crimes and we're blaming it on reform without the data to provide the support that makes that support evidence to support that claim. So we have a lot of folks that are pushing to revise or to remove that reform because of the fact that the assumption is that there's more crime rates When in reality, mm-hmm. there's a lot of issues that are currently happening in the state of New York that require like multiple attention and which have an influence in criminal justice. Wow. for those who are involved.
And then going back to you acclimating people out of jail and back to society and community, what are some of the major barriers you face, again, as a social worker in doing that?
It's definitely, I would say one thing is like the assumption of what my role is as a social worker. Is that I'm the social worker, so most of society assumes my focus is medical practice. And so much of the work that I do, I would say to be able to get myself involved in policy work or working on a government level, on a political level, or a community organizing level, community organizing, I wouldn't include with levels that involve legislation because they're each of its own. But in that, when it comes to policy work, there's more of this assumption of having a degree from a different program. When you see a social worker, you may not have the assumption that we had to take classes in social policy, or you had to learn about social welfare. And a lot of the issues that are focused on social policies involve the work that we do. But because of our title, we're just like, okay, just like waiting for that response to be a part of a team like that. Or just the sense that I'm a social worker, my responsibilities are more so to doing direct work mm-hmm. as opposed to analytical work.
So then finally, I got to ask you one big question, and it's kind of a fun question I like asking too. If you had a magic wand, it could change one thing about the behavioral health field and what you're going through right now, what would it be and why?
I will say the value of, I would say, if I could change something, it would be working with client suitable and mild clients that fit our capabilities. And what I mean by that is that oftentimes organizations, in mental health field, of course, we're seeing the surge in need of mental health care. Yeah. And as much as the sobriety comes with the clients and the growth of certain percents that are increasing, regarding certain mental health illnesses, it's the uneven ratio with clinicians to clients. And so often that what that tends to do is just like you're working on a caseload of 70, 80 people. And it's just how are you able to develop a trustworthy therapeutic relationship when you're only spending several minutes compared to what would be equitable for folks to be able to manage their mental health and dealing with the secondary trauma that they're experiencing from their clients.
And could that also increase burnout for the clinician as well? Yeah. You're kind of giving them like cookie cutter plans because of the lack of time you spend with them, right?
Yeah. It's very difficult. I mean, now with telehealth, things have become much more effective in a way where folks are able to work in the comfort, but the workload is still the same where folks may experience high levels of high volumes of clients. And having to get through that without burning out is nearly impossible.
So do you think like the clinicians are out there, but these companies just don't want to hire them? Or do we just need more therapists out there in the world?
Do I think we need more? The need of social workers is important. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's more of it's definitely the pay when it comes to experiences that we go through. We're doing a lot for an amount that's basically almost impossible to live on, especially if you live in urban neighborhoods like mm-hmm. New York City or Los Angeles. It's like for a social worker to be able to function and provide the best abilities, the best of their abilities in their work, it's nearly impossible to do that and be able to like work. If you don't have these resources, it's going to be difficult to do your job, and your job ultimately affects the trust on the relationship that clients will have with whatever agency. It's kind of like a domino effect in a way. Mm-hmm. One thing leads to the other, and yet we continue to unsee that or ignore a lot of these red flags that are easily preventable if we had the right pay and we had the benefits that really help us in situations that limit our abilities.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you ever watch any of my early podcast episodes, that's actually a huge passion of mine. It's just we need more money. We need more money for the work that we do, working with clients with severe mental health issues, trauma. It's extremely difficult work, not just intellectually, but like physically too, stress on the body and everything. You know,
there are a lot of social workers who, it's like the saying goes, every therapist has a therapist. And it's just like, you're going to have a social worker that has MNESE, a social worker or a therapist, not because of how, not solely because of the work, but how the work is impacting their lives. And it's ultimately, it just becomes very stressful because this is, these are professions, just like other underpaid professions like teaching. We came into the world, the position to, because we love it. We love helping people. We love teaching. But because of how the system itself is continuously pushing in numbers and focusing on that numbers aspect or the quantitative aspect, we deal with the repercussions of burnout.
Yeah, and it kind of makes it seem like, what am I thinking of? Like, we're just being taken advantage of, you know, and that's what it always irritates me when another counselor would, let's say, come up to me and be like, hey, well, you know, we're not doing it for the pay. And I always get irritated. It's like, no, like you saying that strengthens that stereotype that we don't deserve to get paid. You know, I want to be in a world where it's just like, why can't we, again, make a good salary, make good money, good benefits, and take care of our clients at the same time? Why don't we deserve that? You know what I mean? So that's...
Yeah, it's difficult because we really have to push for we fight for our roles and we fight for equality and the type of, in the sense of resources that we can get and the type of pay that that fits our, that we earned, and we're still kind of we're undermined by a lot of professions in multiple fields, mental health and medical health. We're in other areas as well. We're kind of seen as the lesser of the two. Mm-hmm. So that's, but, and of course the other, like one issue that kind of stems from that is how effectively social workers are able to advocate for these. We're kind of undermined by that skill set. And I think that's where a lot of loss for those who don't think that advocacy on a policy level or not just policy on in government sense, but policies within the workplace as well. I mean, there are policies that your agency will institute, will enact and memo out that clinicians have to have 50 clients as a minimum. And sometimes as social workers, we see that and it's just like, this is crazy. Yeah. But are we really asking, what can we do to fight against this? Because this is insane as a clinician to be able to provide that many services to that amount of people. And so we kind of have taught ourselves or have been accustomed by the systems around that we work to really fall into that sense of more work.
Well, Crescendo, I just want to say it's been an honor and pleasure having you on my podcast, man. I know myself, my listeners, we learned so much from you and everything. And but before we go, would you like to give my audience like maybe some information about yourself, how they can get a hold of you, like a number or email or whatever?
Yeah, so I do have LinkedIn, so I'm not sure. So I definitely am, if you follow me and message me, more than happy to answer any questions. Like I said, aside from being a social worker and psychotherapist, I am also an adjunct professor and a graduate research assistant. And much of my work revolves around the social work lens, criminal justice, juvenile justice, and immigration system on a social work lens, and how we're able to be more engaged in policy and the big picture of society.
Absolutely, man. All right. Well, again, it's been an honor, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate being here tonight and being able to share what I know.
All right. Well, that does it for another great episode of Behavior Health Integration. I just want to inform everyone that the content of this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issue, seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health and addiction professional. All right. Thank you and have a good day. Bye.